From the Sky News Centre at 5, the FBI says it has enough evidence that North Korea was behind the cyber attack on Sony Pictures. There's a suggestion there could be a Chinese link too. Yesterday, the studio decided to shelve the release of a film mocking leader Kim Jong-un. Our US correspondent Hannah Thomas-Peter has more.
There are reports that these hackers, calling themselves the Guardians of Peace, have released another message to Sony Pictures, praising them for their decision to pull the movie and saying that that company's data will now be secure unless, quote, you make additional trouble.
Merseyside police are investigating whether one of their constables who was killed on a night out in Liverpool was targeted because he was recognised from his work. 36-year-old Neil Doyle died following the attack in the early hours of this morning. Two of his colleagues were injured. UEFA President Michel Platini says FIFA's decision to publish a legally appropriate version of the report into alleged World Cup bidding corruption is a step in the right direction. Platini's FIFA counterpart Sepp Blatter says Russia's 2018 and Qatar 2022 won't have the tournament taken away from them.
No, the decision which has been taken in 2nd of December 2010 stands and there is no reward to take.
Women could be able to fight in a close combat role by 2016. A government commissioned report has found female soldiers would have no adverse effect on the way troops work together, but more research is going to be carried out on the physical demands of the job. Former Liverpool manager Kenny Dalglish has told the Hillsborough Inquest how he feared for his son's safety on the day of the disaster. Paul Dalglish was among the crowd that spilled onto the pitch after the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest was stopped. And Cheryl Fernandez-Versini's husband has accepted damages over a magazine article speculating about their secret wedding. Jean-Bernard sued the publishers of Heat. They settled for an undisclosed fee. And that's the latest. I'm Caroline Henderson.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, our last show until 3 weeks' time on the 9th of January. Helping you review this week's news, we've cleared the decks of those elected politicians for a community activist from the Marsh Farm estate in Luton, Bedfordshire. It's Glenn Jenkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we try and winkle out the true motives behind Monday's Sydney siege and Tuesday's school massacre in Peshawar and look at the implications of the EU rapprochement towards Palestine and the US government swivelling its guns away from Cuba towards Russia. Plus, the latest in our investigations into the disappearance at the end of the war of Hitler's money man, Martin Bormann. This week, we hear from the Russians. Then, back to the real politics, not politricks. That's community activism, how Bristol's linking up with activists 100 miles east in Bedfordshire to do some bottom-up development, or BUD, turning the pyramid upside down. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 11, sunny spells on Saturday, wet and windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, wow, what a mild Christmas, mainly wet and windy week with some sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 27th, 28th of December, highs of 11 degrees and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, community activists from the Marsh Farm Estate in Luton, Bedfordshire. That's Glenn Jenkins. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tom.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Community activist, what does that actually mean?
Well, I've been involved for probably 25, 30 years in what I'd call community activism. And you mentioned bottom-up development. It's kind of by the community, for the community. So building democracy, economy, reclaiming local economies, all that kind of thing, but generally built from the bottom up, from the grassroots up, so inside out development rather than outside in.
Okay, well, that's the theory. What's the actual practice on the ground? What does that mean?
basically, some of the work we've been doing on Marsh Farm Estate, I'm a big believer in working in small areas, yeah, because you can make an impact, and then templates and models and stuff like that, and you can measure the benefit in a small area. So I work on an estate called Marsh Farm in Luton, which is 3,200 households, 10,000 people. And we've basically been working on measuring our local economy, our GDP, if you like, how much money comes in, how much money goes out, and whether some of that can be trapped in order to create enterprise jobs, etc. But at the same time, if they're cooperative enterprises, organising as a community around the workplace.
But what does that... Sorry, I'm going to pull you back. What do you actually mean by that? Well, are you actually able to create the sort of businesses within that area? Because that's the trouble, isn't it? Most people, where they live, they're spending their money, you know, not just... not on their local shops anymore and the local immediate area. They're travelling to spend it. They're spending it either at retail parks. Certainly, they're not spending it locally as much as they used to.
That's the big part of the problem, Tony, and part of our mission in life is to, like, as I say, when we measured our economy, there was some amazing amounts of money. I'll give you one example. Our estate, just our estate, spends almost £1 million a year just on car servicing, MOTs, maintenance, things like that. So the idea is for us to set up a social enterprise in Marsh Farm, which we've canvassed the estate, said to people, would you use a social enterprise car mechanics garage doing your MOT, etc., locally? Because our figures show that they use 28 different garages all within 10 miles of the estate. And 90% of people, when surveyed, which is always different in practice, but when surveyed, said that they would certainly use a local garage which created job opportunities locally, lock some of that spending back into the community to recirculate it, and provide training and employment opportunities for some of our kids who need that most. So a lot of strong support for it in word, and indeed we'll find out in March 2015, because that's when we launch it.
Oh, really? So that hasn't actually happened yet. But, I mean, let's go back to the 90s, because I know you were involved in the rave scene as well, weren't you? Mm. Now, that was quite, I found, wonderful in its own mad way, because it was about reclaiming spaces. It was about the right to party, the freedom to party. Mm. And I know that you had some big landowners, didn't you, over in Luton, in Bedfordshire, some of these sort of lord this and that, that you started to actually have raves deliberately explaining to the people who were turning up who owned the land and why you were having a rave on their particular bit of land. So tell us a little bit about those, I'd like to say battles, I'd say maybe gentle... I don't know, probably not that
battles,
gentle.
Battles is a good word.
Is it really?
It's a good word.
But, no, yeah, I mean, the local gentry, effectively.
And it's ongoing as well, you know, our dances still happen. And, you know, but just to say, that's a classic example of what we call plugging the economic leaks, yeah? So, normally, we would spend our money, if we've got any money to spend, in nightclubs, pubs, clubs, etc. And then there's a big raft of people who are excluded from that kind of activity. So what we did throughout the 90s was civil disobedience campaign, occupying different parts of land, as you say, fully aware of who the so-called landowner was, and making a campaign to speak directly to them people to say, look, this is a right to access land issue, as well as the freedom to party and right to have some sort of social economy instead of being exploited in expensive nightclubs.
Well, no one really minds you wandering across on a footpath across the land, but actually turning up on somebody's estate having an all-night party is another matter, really.
Well, we call it Zulu drums, you know, it makes a lot of noise and it draws attention, and it's, you know, it's much better than violent protests, isn't it? You know, I mean, you set up in a sand quarry, 10,000 people dancing when the sun comes up, it's just not only a beautiful feeling, it's an ancient thing, you know, the actual communing, if you like, gathering once a month with other people in a celebration of not-for-profit, not-for-private-gain enterprise.
Did you find there were any big landowners that were happy with you doing that, or was it all...
Well, it was a bit grumpy at first, obviously, but we went out of our way, and still do go out of our way, to make positive communications with them and say, look, you know, ultimately we need to sit down. And we ended up sitting down with the Duke of Bedford, who I've got to say, you know, was absolutely great geezer. When we got to meet him and we were able to communicate to him what our aspirations were, there was a TV programme made about it, and he freed up several pieces of land. And he said to us, look, here's some land, which, because one of the bits of land we was using was near his 18th golf course. He's got a golf course with the 18th hole and Tiger Woods coming and all. So he didn't want Exodus kicking up jungle drum and bass beats on the golf course. So he was a bit pressured into speaking to us, but I have to say that he started speaking to us after, I think, 36 police operations to try and stop us. So it weren't, oh, let's all jump into this party. And it was a case of us using our community power, if you like, in terms of the number of people mobilising, convoying through the town. One time they arrested us and stole the sound system, so 4,000 people non-violently surrounded the police station all night. Soon got the sound system back in the morning, you know what I mean? So, you know, and because we've always been non-violent, we've always been completely transparent about it, who we are. It's civil disobedience, it's not criminality. We're breaking law in order to make law, you know, so we've been to court and made our case and all of that. And, you know, I found that with the Duke of Bedford and many other landowners, in the end, they thought, well, you know, sanity prevails here. You know, it's better to sit down and make accommodations for these kind of things. And that's an ongoing campaign, Tone, because what we need to do now in Luton is give that a permanent home, that regular celebrationary event of 4,000 or 5,000 people in a place called Sundon Pits, which is a massive chalk pit, right, only 2 miles away from Marsh Farm. And it's an ideal spot for a regular monthly festival. So imagine a tented village, not just doing raves, you know, but doing all kinds of genre nightclubs, all that kind of thing, but within tents. So instead of a festival where it comes, you set it up and you take it away after 3 days, this is a permanent fixture which we're campaigning for. And that would generate enough funding to not only pay for the site and make that commonly owned, but also to generate a fairly healthy budget every year for autonomous community development stuff. So it just makes sense, you know. It's about using the money we spend in a much more socially productive way, basically.
Now, you say, I think it's a bit cheeky, really, we're breaking the law to make the law. Well, that's not keeping the law, is it? So what do you mean by that? You're saying civil disobedience. Now, that sounds great, but what you're actually saying is, well, in order to get what we want, we just want to break the law. Now, that's criminal, surely.
Criminal in the eyes of the state. I've been to court. I've been on TV saying I'm a campaigner for legalised cannabis as well. Not because I think, oh, well, everyone should have, you know, smoking weed. It's about a massive, massive portion of young people who are excluded from the mainstream in our country because they choose a more sane use of drugs. You know, they don't go into the pub and get steaming drunk and come out fighting on Saturday nights. They're more happy sitting. So we campaign for that, and the way we campaign for it is smoked it openly on the telly, said to the police, look, come and arrest us, yeah, because we're growing our own weed here. We want a court case. And unfortunately, in the UK, court is often one of the best platforms where you can have to make your case. So it's, for me, what I mean by making the law, breaking the law to make the law, is I'm prepared, I've been prepared and still am, to break unjust laws and then go to court and face the music for that. So that's the difference between civil disobedience and criminality, where you break the law in order to self-gain and hide from the police. You know, that's a different thing altogether. It's an honourable tradition in this country, and it's timeless, and I'm looking a big dose of it again in 2015, if I'm honest.
Okay. You mentioned cannabis. That's been in the news this week. Could cannabis oil reverse the effects of cancer? And this is in The Independent, Kate Hilpen, yesterday. As a film following six patients receiving the controversial treatments released, Kate Hilpen uncovers a very slippery issue. In the summer of 2012, George Wilkins, documentary filmmaker, was in his friend's health food shop when a customer walked in, looking exceptionally ill. He walked up to the counter and asked for hemp oil to treat his lung cancer, explains the 29-year-old from Hull. When I quizzed him, it turned out he was muddling hemp oil with cannabis oil. Still, I thought, why would you want that? So when I got home, I started researching it and found some quite compelling, proper scientific evidence about the huge benefits of cannabis oil for cancer patients. Meanwhile, the health of the guy who came into the shop improved significantly within just a month of taking it. Now, that does sound, on the surface of it, like there is some real medicinal benefits to this substance, which is criminalised.
Well, again, that's another really crucial point. I mean, if you there's no difference really between hemp and cannabis, actually. I mean, marijuana was the Mexican name, as I understand it, for hemp. But because it was prohibited in America in the 20s and 30s and stuff, and, you know, Reefer Madness, all these propaganda films, they wanted to give it a kind of more dangerous sound in marijuana, you know, give it a kind of loco weed kind of tag. So, and the thing is with hemp, it's not only medicinally, there's magic involved. And to be honest with you, Tony, as a long-term campaigner, I used to say these things 25 years ago and people think you're crazy. Now they've done scientific tests in labs and all of that and found out that cannabinoids, the active ingredient within cannabis, does actually kill many kinds of cancer cells. It actually makes a cancer cell kill itself, if you know what I mean. And what I found out is that what it basically boils down to is that when your endocannabinoid system, which runs through your whole body, which is what your immune system's based on, when your immune system fails in being able to create enough antibodies in order to kill certain diseases, that's often because of a lack of endocannabinoids in the blood. And there's only two places, as I understand it, where you can get cannabinoids outside of the body. One is in baby mother's milk, and the other is from the weed plant. So it's got magical qualities in terms of medicinal use, as well as industrial production, you know, clothes, paper, rope. It used to be against the law that you had to grow weed in the war, because they called it Hemp for Victory campaign, because it's such a usable and such a durable, and remember, it turns in 3 months, not 6 months or a year, in terms of its crop rotation. So in all ways, it's a really amazing plant. And some of the work we're doing in Marsh Farm, we're looking at, as I'll tell you about later, we're looking at hemp for biomass pellet production, so you could actually heat your homes and the estate for using biomass pellets produced from wood, hemp, etc. And hemp's probably the best material for that too. So, you know, it's all round a magic plant, and it's had a bad name because it's been criminalised for vested interest reasons, I think, and we're here as part of its recovery mission, if you like.
Now, this is a topic I know that old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is quite hot on. Martin, wasn't it criminalised in the United States around about the same time as alcohol was decriminalised? And I think there are some interesting parallels between the prohibition of alcohol and the prohibition of cannabis.
Well, I think what you mean is that alcohol was criminalised and cannabis... alcohol was criminalised and cannabis was criminalised at the same time. What, in actual fact, it was the British who originally criminalised cannabis in the 1920s, I believe, in Egypt, because the locals were eating a lot of hash, and that was regarded as a terrible thing, and they shouldn't do it. And they sat on their verandas sipping their gin and tonics and banned what the locals had been doing for thousands of years. And they found in South Africa what we would call a chillum. It'd obviously been used to smoke cannabis, and that was 40,000 years old. So, in other words, the use of cannabis as it's not really a stimulant, whatever it is, goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Probably longer than alcohol, because alcohol actually requires distillation, whereas cannabis can be used at neat, as it were.
Oh, so, what's the point of prohibition then?
Well, it's cultural stuff, really, isn't it? Other people's drugs are bad. Our drugs are fine. I mean, the British administrators who banned cannabis were happily puffing their cigars and drinking whiskey while they banned it. It was because the natives used it, and therefore it was seen to be problematic. And I think the real issue around all drugs, and not just cannabis, is illegality simply creates parallel markets, huge amounts of illegal funds, which are then used by criminal organisations to back their criminal activities.
I mean, this
including that the Western Intelligence Service.
Well, that's right. I mean, this all links up, doesn't it, with a lot of the bad stuff that's going on in the world. For example, Iran-Contra, the use of the military in the CIA trading large quantities of things like cannabis.
Maybe they did.
Mainly coke and heroin in order to fund military operations. Yeah, a kind of black budget.
So, in other words, the US's position in international negotiations about drugs is always completely hostile to any kind of legalisation or decriminalisation. At the same time, the US intelligence services have a proven record, there don't need any doubt about it. You can go to various websites to look it up, CIADrugs.com, Narco News, it's all on the record. The books have been written. Mike Rupert, who used to run the Los Angeles Police Department's anti-narcotics squad, it's very clear. There's a new film just come out about the journalist Gary Webb. It's called Killing the Messenger. It's a Hollywood film, and Gary Webb uncovered the fact that the CIA were basically importing cocaine into the major cities in the US, using the proceeds to fund a terrorist campaign against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, which killed 30,000 civilians. And that's all on the record. And there's no point. And so when the US says we're against the legalisation of drugs, what they mean is we want to carry on doing it like we do it now, where we have an illegal market which we control, Everybody in Mexico knows that the various cartels are either in bed with the CIA or not in bed with the CIA, and there's a big struggle going on at the minute where all these students have been murdered by the authorities, handed them over to the drug cartel to be murdered. That drug cartel is aligned with the CIA. Other drug cartels are not. So the way it works in Latin America, and this is known right to the top, is that if you work with the Americans, then you are allowed to operate. If you work against the Americans, then you're not.
Well, one of the whistleblowers was saying just literally a couple of weeks ago that HSBC Bank is still working with the some of the Mexican drug cartels.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising, would it? Because they were simply fined a tiny proportion of the profits they made by working with the drug cartel. And on that basis, you might as well carry on doing it, mightn't you?
It starts to look like you've got a kind of city elite, banking elite, that actually are becoming the same as organised crime.
Well, there's no distinction. I mean, the two things.
How has that happened? I mean, surely many people, like ethical banks, like the Co-op, for example, are they also going to go under because of the allegiance of big banks like HSBC with drug money?
The UN Office on Drugs and Crime produced a report in 2009. It's mainly staffed by police officers, and they said, look, what happened in 2008 during the financial crisis is that all the dirty money all over the world, which gets filtered through the system bit by bit, dribble by dribble, just went, there was a big sucking sound and it was all sucked into the banking system. Because if you can imagine, if you are a bank that's about to go under and somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, would you like some cash, your answer is going to be yes. And of course that's what happened. And in other words, the report made the point that without the illegal drugs trade, the banking system would have collapsed. It was rescued by two things: the drug cartels and the global taxpayer. That's how integrated the drugs trade is into the global economy. It's fundamental to the functioning of the financial services sector.
Well, we started just talking about this film about cannabis oil and whether it could reverse the effects of cancer and be actually quite an amazing medicinal cure. And we went right the way there to some of the most hideous and horrendous CIA wars and oppression of the people around the world. Quite an amazing link, really. And I always go back to that film Key Largo, which was starring Humphrey Bogart, which is actually to do with prohibition of alcohol in the States, where I can remember there was some suggestions from politicians that they might want to end prohibition. And of course the drug cartels, the gangsters, the alcohol organised crime people were dead against it. In fact, they were threatening to kill various politicians who wanted to decriminalise alcohol at that time. Anyway, Glenn, back to you and your story. What's your thoughts about some of the other stories this week? Particularly, let's start on one which is one of my favourites from the week, which was in The Guardian. I don't think any other of the newspapers covered it on Wednesday very well, but The Guardian definitely did. And that is the revelation that one of the witnesses at the Hillsborough trial is saying that the senior police officers from South Yorkshire Police actually got together at a Masonic lodge immediately after the disastrous Hillsborough game to basically fix their stories, to collude, to pervert the course of justice and fix their stories so that they would blame an innocent officer. And that was one of the reasons why it looks like, potentially anyway, we have to see by the end of the inquest, much of the horrors, really, of the cover-up of the Hillsborough disaster happened.
No, I mean, you know, Tony, as much as they try with their PR offensive, saying we're just a badminton club and we're a society with secrets, not a secret society, and all that kind of stuff. I think most people who have spent any time over half hour looking into the role of Freemasonry around police, councils, government, etc., will find that in many, many, many cases, they're involved in what seems to be, I think they would justify it as trying to protect the order, trying to protect the system, you know, from damage. And they would say, well, anybody who we have to frame or exclude or whatever is a price worth paying.
Protecting national security, perhaps?
National security, you know, they would say, like Lord Denim once said, didn't he, you know, rather an innocent man rots in prison than the integrity of the British justice system gets challenged. That's their kind of view, is that there's this big worthwhile system that needs defending. They very much play a part in controlling
But in what way is Freemasonry, do you think, different then then to, say, just a golf club or you know, any other membership organisation?
We don't get ritually murdered to get in a golf club for a start as part of the entrance examination. You know, if they said to me, join a golf club, and you get ritually murdered and lowered into a coffin with a noose round your neck and a knife against your heart in order to join the golf club, I'd probably go and play somewhere else, you know what I mean? So there's a big difference, and that's part of their PR offensive, is to try and play it off as just some sort of boys' club. But what it actually is a secret society where people identify each other through secret symbology, where buildings are made with specific marks on them in order to triumph, either to, you know, trumpet their power or to signal their power to other people. And, you know, it's on the American dollar. You've got the Freemason sign, the all-seeing eye, and that on the American dollar. So this whole we're just a badminton club is a PR offensive to play down the role that they do. And not only is that a key difference, I think you'll also find that time after time in the UK, I've been involved in this myself, because we've been attacked in Bedfordshire by Freemasons because of the leisure industry impact we had. We dropped pub takings by 40% when we put on a big dance out in the quarry. And next thing, police officers have spoke out publicly saying, look, we've been leaned on by politicians because of the drop in the brewery profits. And when we traced that back, there was Freemasons all over it.
But how do you actually know that somebody's a Freemason? Do they come up to you and say, hi, I'm a Mason?
Exactly not. They don't do that. That's the point. I mean, we had to do our own research and dig out membership books, which were previously private, you know, and we found that the leader of Luton's Labour Council, for example, you know, the so-called socialist leader of the town, was an active Freemason, and none of his colleagues in the socialist group believed it, never mind knew it. When we told them, they just could not believe it, you know. So there's this, and you know, they're kind of covering all bases, really. And what I found in Bedfordshire was that the justice system, the political system, the economic system, in all aspects of Luton's business and community arm, there is an influence which is unhealthy and overpowerful for the number of people we're talking about, which does contort and distort, and, you know, whether it be the actual press, the Labour Party, the pub trade, you know, boxing, they're all over it, mate, yeah? And what it's all about at the end of the day is vested interest. It's about keeping power in certain groups where you feel that person's all right to share power. This person's never going to get anywhere near it, and Freemasons is a vehicle for that. It's a vehicle for retaining power in certain places.
Now most businesses, certainly all larger businesses, have a probity policy, which is basically about being open about your associations with outside groups, outside bodies, even people within the organisation. Every group has a probity policy. I've never yet seen a probity policy in any organisation that actually mentions secret societies. So in a way, what you've got there is a probity policy that doesn't mean a thing. If you've got one of the most deeply embedded secret societies that is not being disclosed, there's not a lot of point in you saying, well, yes, I'm a member of the golf club. But then one of the most pernicious parts of this, surely, and actually quite seriously criminal, is where you've got, say, for example, a Masonic judge in a court case making a decision over two opposing parties, one of which is a Freemason, and that he knows socially through the lodge.
Absolutely.
And has that ever happened to you?
Again, we had our own experience of we were in fact in the end, Bedfordshire County Council voted unanimously for a civil rights inquiry chaired by Michael Mansfield QC into the activities of Bedfordshire Police and others, and the "and others" were the Freemasons, against the Exodus Collective "and others". Us and our associates were targeted for 66 police operations launched against us, 27 fraudulent charges, every one of which collapsed. But when we got to court, Tony, on the way to court, while we were waiting for court, we found out that this Labour leader guy was a Freemason. We reported it to the Labour group. They refused to do anything about it. They said, oh, he left in 1985 because the book we had was 84. And so we squatted the town hall. 70 or 80 of us went down, occupied the town hall, sang songs like "Davis is a Mason" and stuff like that, noised it up, got the press in there. And we eventually found a book from 96, and he was still in there. You know, now the point being that nobody in the probity policy of the council, you're supposed to declare these things. I went to the Home Affairs Select Committee to see Chris Mullin, and he was supposed to be passing some rules that said that all Freemasons in the police, etc., had to declare. That was resisted and never happened. He was took off the job.
I know, he was. I think he was either the chairman of, or certainly one of the main people at the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is actually one of the most important committees of the House of Parliament. For example, the one at the moment that's looking into Westminster paedophile rings, this kind of thing. So what? How come they made some sort of decision at Home Affairs Select Committee and then that was kicked out into the long grass?
Well, that shows you the power of the Freemasons, you know. When you've got supposedly the sovereign authority in the country, Parliament, saying we demand that you open up your books and show us who, and they get a middle finger salute from not only the Freemasons generally, but St James's Lodge, which is made up largely of police officers in London, etc. If you look in the Guardian, there was a big expose, and they were basically middle fingering it. They were saying, we don't care what you say, we don't care about what the elected authority says, we are not going to reveal names and duties of our members. Now, you know, for me, if that was me, I'd have said, well, I'm giving you a sergeant at arms order, and if you don't do it, you'll be arrested, because that's what would happen to me if there was allegations of criminal conspiracy and I was told to reveal by a court, because remember, the Home Affairs Select Committee isn't just a group of geezers, it's got, and ladies, it's got powers, yeah? And what they should have done is summoned them back and said, look, we insist, and if you don't, you'll be given 28 days and you'll be here for contempt of Parliament or whatever, however they can do it. Call in the Sergeant of Arms and drag them off. But of course, the Masons in this country are more powerful than any elected government, I believe, in turn, because they're, you know, you don't vote for heads of big city institutions, you don't vote for bankers, you don't vote for all these oligarchs in Britain, and yet they're in power no matter who's in government. Do you know what I mean?
It's almost like the permanent government there.
It is.
Anyway, back to the case this week. Senior South Yorkshire police officers who were Freemasons orchestrated a Masonic conspiracy to shift the blame after the Hillsborough disaster in 1989. The inquests into the deaths of the 96 victims have been told. Maxwell Groom, a constable at the time, said after the disaster at the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest at Sheffield Wednesday's football ground, the word inside the force was that Freemason officers held a meeting to blame Superintendent Roger Marshall. Groom said he heard that the meeting took place in a portable cabins at South Yorkshire Police's area office and was attended by Chief Superintendent David Duckenfield, who commanded the match. Questioned by Michael Mansfield, QC, representing 75 families whose relatives were killed at Hillsborough, Groom said he believed Duckenfield was a Grand Master of a particularly influential lodge in Sheffield. I wonder, this certainly seems to be some evidence coming out about Hillsborough. I wonder, Glenn, what your thoughts are about other scandals that might also include Freemasons. I mean, you've had your own experience of it. What else?
Well, if you're looking generally across the country, you know, this paedophile activity that's been going on. Once again, you know, when we were forced to look into the connections between our MPs, our local MPs, and the brewing industry, we had two MPs. One was called John Carlyle, who was a Conservative MP. He was famous for sending South African wine to the anti-apartheid movement. He'd do things like that, you know. He's a very right-wing character. And Graham Bright, our other MP, was personal private secretary to John Major when he was Prime Minister. Now, before he was PPS to John Major, he was PPS to a guy called Malcolm St Clair. Now, Sinclair, right, are of, what's that book called, the Mason book, the recent book that Dan Brown wrote?
Oh, Da Vinci Code.
That centres around Roslyn Chapel, etc. So it's a very Masonic, Templary kind of family. And Graham Bright was PPS to him, and then PPS to the Prime Minister. So it was like he was PPS to the unseen government, and then PPS to the seen government, within 3 years of each other. And when we investigated this guy's connections to the brewing industry, we found out that one of the breweries, Whitbread, because Sam Whitbread lives in Bedfordshire with us as well, one of his main lobbyists was a guy called Ian Greer. Now, Ian Greer Associates, was a scandalised company. He was involved in Cash for Questions with Al Fayyad and all that kind of thing. And when we researched this guy, we found all these allegations about Dolphin Square. Simon Regan from Scallywag he wrote an article called Boys for Questions, which was actually about what's all coming out now, you know, in terms of Dolphin Square being used as a place for VIP MPs, judges, that kind of thing. And The name Derek Lord and the name Greer were two of the people who were associated or alleged to have been associated with something to do with these parties. And it was said by Simon Regan that he felt that there was actually what Martin was talking about, secret services involved in taking pictures of people and blackmailing them. Now, when I looked at my MP, and I looked, he had a role in the NSPCC, the Scouts, the Choral Society, you know, I mean, very, very, very children-orientated work. And I'm thinking, how can you be doing all of that and having an association with this guy, a friendship, actually, with this guy, who's accused of doing all of that? So as that story's gathered more traction in terms of the paedophile abuse rings at the heart of Parliament, I think you'll find there's Masons all over that too. And people have been killed investigating this. Simon Regan died. His brother died when he was trying to pick up Simon Regan's investigations, and he died. You know, so there's all this mystery.
We were talking just on this show back late in the late summer about the death of Stephen Milligan MP, and a couple of weeks, in fact, I think maybe even just a couple of days before he died, he'd said, I'm going to clean up the Tory party. I'm going to get the perversion out of the party. And then he's found in some sort of weird sexual pose. And certainly for most people that are looking at that nowadays, they think, well, actually what he was doing was trying to get out into the public domain quite a lot of what we're seeing today. Anyway, more recently, on this latest scandal, VIP paedophile networks shut down police investigations which got too close, claim retired police officers. This is the 13th of December. Almost 30 former detectives have turned whistleblower in an online forum to expose how undercover operations were suddenly canned by powerful figures. This was in the news last weekend. High-level probes into VIP paedophile networks were shut down as police closed in on a number of powerful figures, former officers claim. In an extraordinary development, detectives have turned whistleblowers to expose how undercover operations were canned. Almost 30 officers were venting their anger online, heaping pressure on the probe by Scotland Yard and the government into widespread claims of historical sexual abuse. One former officer called Jim wrote, "This is all about kids being raped by those in power and included politicians of all sorts. It goes to the very heart of the establishment." The allegations surfaced during a four-month investigation by XRO News website into a secret members-only chat forum used by former and serving Metropolitan Police officers. Martin, is this actually going to see the light of day finally this time, do you think, this scandal? And are people going to go to court and eventually to jail?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, it takes years for these things to come out, but then the potential is that the momentum that eventually develops brings out more than has come out for a very long time.
Well, it seems what's driving that momentum is actually the Jimmy Savile revelations from last year, really the big story of the year, because a lot of people who have been thwarted in their attempts to get justice before now feel a little buoyed up by the fact that you've got this major figure right at the heart of the BBC, very friendly with Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, also very friendly with the NSPCC, one of the major charities that's supposed to be caring for children, also very friendly with the royal family, someone in such a key position to be shown to be one of the worst offenders of child sexual abuse this country's ever seen, is giving, I think, a bit more credibility to those who are coming forward. And it was quite good to hear last weekend the People's Tribunal starting up, with Michael Mansfield involved, heading it up, to do what the Home Office and Theresa May won't, Glenn, because the main reason being, of course, because if there is an inquiry that rolls out in the new year, they're going to lose the next election, the Conservative Party, because it looks as if many of these were Tory figures.
I think it goes deeper than that, mate. I don't think it is about they'll lose the next election. I think it's about they'll lose credibility as an institution, as a whole institution. I mean the British establishment, because I've always said this, Tony, when we were looking and researching this and I saw it, made me the hair on the back of my neck stand up, because for most rational, normal, decent human beings, the whole idea of hurting a child, never mind depraved abuse of child with sexual, you know, it's just beyond most people's perception. And I went for a few years where I just couldn't believe it. I thought, no, this is too fantastic to be true. But as I looked into it, and as I became more and more scared that this was actually a real happening in an organised, institutional way. And I think Theresa May is just Theresa May. Yeah? She's the latest in a long line of Home Secretaries, and they change them like I change earrings, you know what I mean? They move through. But what you've actually got here is something much deeper than that. And people within the establishment, I think, are beholden to the fact that there's certain places you just don't go. There's certain things you just don't say, because you'll threaten your own position, you'll threaten your, sometimes your life, you know. And I think, you know, look at Stephen Milligan, look at that Secret Services guy a few months ago, a couple of years ago maybe, they found him zipped up in a bag. He was supposed to have zipped up himself, you know. And yeah, what that Gareth does, Williams. It sends messages out to people saying, listen, there's lines you do not cross, right? And that leads to a silence where there should be roaring.
Many years ago, Ken Livingston, when he was first elected for Brent to the Houses of Parliament, he gave a maiden speech. Now, when you give a maiden speech in the House of Parliament, it's supposed to be, thank you very much for having me. But he got up and he made a speech about the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland.
Right.
Because the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland was being used by MI5 as a honey trap. So they were basically getting loyalists, what seemed at that stage to be loyalist paramilitaries, of course, who were all good Protestants who were not in favour of homosexuality and so on and so forth. And they were getting them in there, having sex with underage boys, and then photographing them and using it as blackmail.
And Tree just shut that one out.
Well, it's across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland, Kinkora is understood to be a scandal. So you've got, you know, Peter Robinson, who's the head of the devolved government there, and the loyalist side, they're not happy about it, and nor's anybody else. And of course, that was the tip of the iceberg. I suspect that all of these safe houses, if you like, have been used for years as a means of political control by the intelligence services. And we, of course, the we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. But if you think about the kind of gay subculture that there was in MI5 and MI6 in the 1940s and 1950s, Burgess and Maclean and all these people, and don't forget, homosexuality was completely illegal until the 60s.
Exactly.
So in other words, these guys would be in the secret services in senior positions, having sex with their boyfriends, as well they might, but these boyfriends are 19, and that seems to be all right. But of course, then of course, if we're going to break the law, then we're going to break the law. And then, of course, you start to get the paedophilia aspects building in. And think of the culture where these people come from, like Heyman, who is deputy head of MI6, who's definitely been fingered as being involved in this Dolphin Square stuff. I think the real scandal behind all of this is it's being used by the intelligence services, and that means our intelligence services probably working with the Americans. We covered the Franklin scandal,
Belgium,
and the Dutroux affair in Belgium. So that's what's really the elephant in the room here. This isn't just people using their positions of power to follow their own personal predilections. It's the abuse of various predilections in order to retain and control the political power. And that's the real scandal. And of course, it links also, I mean, there's another big elephant in the room is the role of the Western intelligence services in the promotion and creation of terrorism, particularly of the Islamic variety. So what we're dealing with here is we've got an ostensible democracy. That's what we teach people in schools. And in practice, we've got a corrupt oligarchy with a democratic facade.
Well, yes. Well, there is one other sort of side I'd like to look at this week, and that is the sort of downside to all of this, which is the UK welfare reforms. And the UK is a campaign called Black Triangle, which I believe is the symbol that in Nazi Germany that disabled people were forced to wear. The Black Triangle campaign has been keeping an eye on the number of people who've died as a result of Ian Duncan Smith and David Cameron and the coalition government's welfare reforms. Their updated list, it was published actually just at the end of October, but I've only just come across it, I'm afraid. Their campaign website, Black Triangle, is absolutely brilliant. It's got some fantastic information on there, but pretty horrifying. There's a list here which runs to individuals and couples died, some suicide, and others who have just simply been told they're fit for work and literally the next week dropped dead. It runs to around about 80 people, and so we've got this kind of rather frightening prospect of some of the most vulnerable people in our society, Glenn, with this present government actually being deprived of the basic things they need to live, such as food through food banks and accommodation through benefits being cut in that way, the bedroom tax, that kind of thing, and also some of the basic support services that they've always been used to having. So, I mean, have you seen the results of this sort of thing in your estate over in Marsh Farm?
Very, very, very much so. We've seen the results of this kind of thing in Marsh Farm. I mean, I've got personal experience of people I know and love who are, you know, have been excluded from, sanctioned from the dole because they're no good at paperwork, because they might have missed an appointment. You know what I mean? Life stuff, yeah? Because some people's life is quite chaotic for different reasons. Sometimes they might have issues to deal with, might have domestic issues, might have mental issues. You know, there's no mercy. It's straight, bang, you're gone. And I've had to do a lot of work myself with people in our community and the agencies to try and get some sort of sanity from it. And do you know what, Tony? In the agencies themselves, there's people who there who say this is callous and it's a disregard for people's rights, but there's the rules. It's coming down from Ian Duncan Smith downwards. And you know, when you look at some of the, I mean, you just talked about 80 odd people who have tragically died, and that's a tragedy in anyone's book. Then there's the thousands and thousands and thousands who haven't died, but they're in such turmoil, you know, such life disrepair, their life's in disrepair because they've been forced into situations where benefit cuts have made them so that they're at food banks if they dare go there, etc. So we deal a lot at a time with people like that. And what really makes me sick about it is I read something the other day, yeah, this so-called deficit we've got. If you was to have a 10% wealth tax on the 20% richest people in the country, you could clear the deficit overnight. A 10% wealth tax on their paintings, on their stocks, on their shares. And remember, the rich are the people who made out of this so-called economic crash. Money doesn't disappear. It went from the poor to the rich. So if you own 5 houses and you're a buy-to-let landlord, you benefited greatly from the surge, the unsustainable bubble that grew in housing. So for me, they're the people who should be paying for the deficit, not the poor and the disabled and the weak and people who couldn't borrow money if they wanted to because they were the credit blacklisted.
But you see, what we've had for many years is the nanny state, the welfare state, which has been just simply paying people, whatever it is, £60, £70, £100 a week to do nothing. That's not sustainable, surely.
No, well, if you went to if your car broke and you just had it fixed at a mechanic's garage, you'd be blaming the mechanic for that, not yourself. And same way, if politicians' job is to create jobs and economy and make sure that the economy functions to a point where people can have meaningful employment, and they fail in that to such a crass degree, where there's millions and millions of people without productive work for decades, and then take a policy where they stick you on the sick rather than on the dole to make it look to Europe like this Blair model's working, then the government are responsible for that. I know people who are third generation benefit dependents, yeah? And believe me, it isn't the life of Riley. It's a horrible life, and it's all about scrimping and scraping from day to day to day to day. And you know, to suggest that those people are in some way in luxury or benefiting from this handout. So what I believe is that what we should do is set about creating meaningful work for people, and until we've done that, we have a duty to take care of the people who we disabled ourselves by making them what you could call benefit dependent, you know, because they've never had anyone in their household working and that. And that's a result of government policy, not lazy citizens.
Martin, you've spoken in the past about this. What is the macroeconomic reason for having this big pool of unemployed people? It seems, you know, it seems to many of us as if it's just an accident that there's a large number of unemployed. You know, back in the 1970s, there was virtually full employment. There was a very, very good easy. It was easy to get work. Nowadays, it's extremely difficult, and many people spend much of their life. Actually, we had a news story, didn't we, earlier in the year, where they did a survey and said that over 50% of people really wanted to get out of their job and wanted another job. So if half the people out there actually don't like the job they're presently in, it's not delivering, is it? And the reason they're staying in those jobs that they don't like is because of this mass pool of unemployed.
Well, I mean, from 1945 until about 1970, we had pretty much full employment in most Western economies.
Amazing to think that right after the Second World War, even, pretty much everybody was given a job.
That's because what the war had done is it had shocked everybody into understanding that hanging around waiting for the market to deliver was a nonsense policy.
I mean, when there were all those bombed buildings left after the war, people didn't say, the government didn't say, sorry, there's not enough money to employ you to fix them up.
No, they didn't.
They got on and did it.
That's right. And there was an understanding that the state had a duty, a responsibility, and the capacity to create full employment, and full employment was created. Now, there are various theories about why this, what they call the Keynesian era, because after the economist John Maynard Keynes broke down. One of them is that, oh, it was inflation, it was to do with the oil price.
Well, let's have your take.
Well, to be honest with you, there's two aspects to it. One is that it's to do with capital accumulation. Eventually, you've got too many people producing cars, for example. So, you know, the Japanese, the Germans and the Americans can't all be in the same market. Now, when that happens, of course, they don't exit the market because you've invested so much time and energy and resources in building up your car industry. So what you do is you sell your cars for less than their cost of production, and that's what everybody else has to do, and that gradually undermines profitability. There is another or competing theory that it was the wage push theory, that trade unions were strong, they pushed for wage increases which couldn't be sustained, and that's what forced inflation. I think that's and there was a kind of left version of that, which was that we, you know, it was the workers' struggle that undermined the profitability of capitalism and then created the crisis. I think capitalism creates its own crisis because it's a disproportional system. It's not a planned system.
Okay, Glenn, what's your theory?
I just wanted to add something to that. My mate Steve has just been doing one of our outreach team members on Marsh Farm. He's been at university doing a degree in usury and mammonomics, as we call it, mammonomics, rather
economics.
Than economics, mammonomics, But anyway, and he showed me this piece of work he's done, which dug out some information. Basically, said that in a capitalist economy, as Martin was just saying, 7% unemployment is the optimum rate for making it the most effective in terms, because you need a large pool of unemployed people in order to suppress and compress the wages of the people who are in work. You need a large pool of unemployed people in order to put pressure on those who are in work to stay in that job, mate, otherwise there's someone else coming in to take it.
Because that's interesting, because the government constantly tries to pit the low-paid against unemployed, whereas actually the unemployed are being used by the government as a weapon against the low-paid.
Well, this is the point, Tony. Sorry, Martin.
All I would say is that the way to deal with this, and the way it was dealt with fairly effectively in Scandinavia, was that you have centralised bargaining, and you bargain for what they used to do in Sweden, is that the trade unions would have their economists, and the employers would have their economists, and they'd agree what the growth of productivity in the economy was over a year. It's usually about 3% in normal times in capitalist economies, just through new technology, new ways of doing things. Things are constantly changing. So then you give everybody across the board a 3% wage increase. And sometimes they used to do solidaristic bargaining and plus an extra amount for people on the lowest incomes. And what that means is that the companies which are doing really well and are actually increasing their productivity, they only have to pay 3%. The workers could demand 7%, but they only get 3%. And that gives the companies that are really doing their job properly and organising the future, they get a big boost. But of course, the crappy companies that can't reach the 3% productivity threshold, they get penalised. And what you eventually do is you push them out of business. You don't want crummy firms that can't pay good wages. And of course, what it requires is a strong trade union movement negotiating in a solidaristic way to redistribute profits and jobs around. And of course, it worked quite well until the Conservatives took over in Sweden in the 90s. They immediately deregulated the banking system. Yippee, off we go. Within 3 years, the banking system had crashed. And of course, the whole model was then destroyed. And in Britain, we tried to have incomes policies in the late 70s. You will remember the 5% wage ceiling, which eventually led to the collapse of the Labour government. But that's because inflation was running at more than 5%. So you're asking poor people to take a wage cut. And that wasn't sustainable. And the unions, it was the rebellion of the low paid, the winter of discontent, which then undermined the Labour government's position. And in any case, incomes policy had never really worked well in Britain because the trade unions had an adversarial mentality, whereas in Sweden and Finland they had a more we're going to take over, and therefore we're going to be responsible in our demands because we're taking over. Anyway,
let's go to Prime Minister's questions from Wednesday this week, the last one of the year, and let's hear something we've been talking about really, which is income inequality, which apparently is hurting the entire economy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the most recent OECD report, number 163 on income inequality, shows that the UK economy would be 20% bigger if the tax policies had redistributed income to the bottom 40% of citizens. Can the Prime Minister resist the temptation to waffle and consider seriously his policies and those of Chancellor Scrooge over his 5 years by rewarding the rich with tax cuts and hammering the middle and low-income people with rises in the cost of living, and not only...
Order! The Prime Minister!
I was just about getting the hang of it, actually. After a while. Look, I think the problem with the Labour Party's attemptive narrative is it simply isn't true. They talk about inequality, but inequality is lower than it was at the election. They talk about poverty, but there are 600,000 fewer people in relative poverty than there were at the election. They talk about child poverty, but there are 300,000 fewer children in relative poverty than at the election. This afternoon, we'll be talking about children. There are 390,000 fewer children in households where no one works than there were in 2010. Those are the facts. They may be inconvenient, but you ought to have a look at them.
Well, the facts are that that was an OECD report, not a Labour Party report. Maybe David Cameron should have a look at them. But what he's saying there, Martin, is that actually the wedge that's being driven between the high and low wage earners actually damages the economy. Why is that?
Well, if you think about it, in the long run, capitalism depends upon having a market to buy the stuff that's produced.
Simple, isn't it, really? There's no one to buy the stuff anymore.
And it's not just in Britain either, it's across the world. I mean, real wages haven't risen in the United States of America effectively since 1973. So in other words, wages stop rising when that crisis kicked in. And of course, then what you do is you lend people money to buy the stuff that they used to be able to buy with their the union wage increase that they used to get. And of course, that can carry on for quite a long while as well before people can't pay it back. But eventually, of course, you've built up the most humongous debt bubble in history. And without the debt, of course, the economy would have collapsed a long time ago. And with the debt, it will collapse eventually.
Something a bit more down to earth for you, though, Glenn. This is Derek Twigg talking about ambulance waiting times at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Derek Twigg!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was contacted at the weekend by a constituent who told me that his 78-year-old mother was left bleeding on the floor, kitchen floor, from a fall, and it took an hour and a half, for the ambulance to attend. Isn't this indicative of the health service under this government? And what is the Prime Minister going to do? What is the Prime Minister going to do to ensure the pressures are eased on the ambulance service?
Minister! What is indicative of the NHS under this government is the fact there are 1,700 more paramedics and 200 more ambulances than when this government came to power. And the reason for that is we didn't listen to the party opposite, who said that it was irresponsible to increase health spending. Instead, we've put £12.7 billion into the NHS. Now, where any ambulance trust falls down, that is a matter of serious regret and should be looked into very carefully, and I'll look into this case as I do with any other.
That's classic, isn't it? You know, I mean, ambulance waiting times, etc., number of people in employment. David Cameron just keeps juggling figures around and presenting it as though everything's fine. In fact, everything's better. You know, and you know, and I know, we all know that the reality on the ground is just because you've got a part-time job doing 0-hour contract hours, maybe 12 hours a week sometimes, if that, and you're off the unemployment list. In David Cameron's world, that means everything's better now. There's more people working. But the reality of the situation is that person's family were better off before they were working, because at least without the money, they had the time.